Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and as we celebrate Labor Day weekend, the Heartland Politics Show is going to examine the state of American labor. And we'll do that with Stephen Franklin, who I'm very pleased to have as a guest. He's a former labor and international affairs reporter with the Chicago Tribune. He also authored an excellent book that really captures the changes that ensnared American workers over the years. The book is called Three Strikes, Labor's Heartland Losses and What They Mean for Working Americans. It's a familiar story. It's about a town about 3 hours from the Quad Cities here in Decatur, Illinois. And I'm really pleased to have Steve to talk about that book, but also the lessons it shares for American workers today. Steve, thank you for being a guest today.
Yeah, thank you, Robin, for a very kind and generous suggestion. You know, it's a story about Decatur, but really it could be the story about all of Illinois, all the Midwest, and all of manufacturing jobs. You know, I covered in the 90s, there were three disputes in Decatur, and they stunned me because they brought together a bunch of issues that I was thinking. I didn't really realize when I started covering them. And in fact, that was sort of my reporting was mistaken, because for a long time, one of the companies, Caterpillar, kept saying, you know, we're a global company. American workers must bring down the wages. I never heard that statement before. They're too well paid. $18 an hour, how terrible that was. And then I suddenly, digging into the story, I realized, oh my goodness, Caterpillar is a giant in the industry. They control the industry. No one's challenging them. They can do what they want. And here's a heartland American company, very proud to be based in Peoria. Many of its executives came off the line. They knew what it was to bend metal, making this argument. And so that's why I did the book. But I, you know, as I spent 4 years doing that, at least 2 years or so, because I had already covered them, but I spent 2 years just going back every weekend, every chance I could, every barbecue, every meeting in Decatur that the three unions and the town folks are getting together to get to know them. So it was a nonfiction book, but it was really novelistic in many ways, because I wanted to tell the story about these workers. I wanted to honor them, to respect them. And, you know, I'll say something about Pete later on. I spend a lot of time among workers. I like being with workers. I've always liked workers. One year I spent a year at a GM factory in Detroit just writing about the plant. And then 1 year, more tragically, I wrote a story about layoffs in the early, this is when I worked in Detroit, about across the country. And the theme there was that workers love their job and they take great respect and great honor. Making a tire is not an issue. It's kind of cruel and dirty. And what astounded me when I went to the tire factory in the Decatur was, they're like they're making cutting diamonds. And one of the outcomes that it's not the major one, but one of the outcomes I kept repeating in the themes of the story is, my job is my life. My job is who I am. I work in this place processing soy, but I love it. It's who I am. It's who I get money to give my kids to send them to school. And it's who allows me to live in this nice home in Decatur, workers would say.
Set the stage here. The title is Three Strikes, like a baseball metaphor. But
so
what are the three strikes that took place against the companies?
Well, there were that's a baseball metaphor. There were three disputes.
Right.
The first case, this is Caterpillar, which basically had a new CEO who said, this is the end of workers' wages rising. And I never heard that remark before from an American CEO. I heard they had to put a limit on it, but his argument was that we're a global company, we compete with companies across the world, and American workers must get off the escalator of wages. And when I looked into it, I basically discovered, oops, Caterpillar is the giant in the industry. They control everything. No one comes near them. And also because what they had wisely moved work out of the U.S. to other companies, the strike that the UAW opposed really didn't make a difference.
They were a profitable company.
Well, no, the secret thing is you can strike a bus company and the bus will go under, but you can't strike Caterpillar or companies that diversify globally because they'll simply move production to Mexico or to Japan or elsewhere. And so that's why going on strike didn't make a difference. So the UAW struck on and off for about 4 years, Caterpillar, and Caterpillar held its ground. And in the initial aspect of the UAW's actions, the UAW, the Caterpillar said, "Well, we're just going to bring in strike breakers." Now, this is, the whole concept. We're one of only three countries in the world that allows strike breakers. And within 2 or 3 days, Caterpillar had 35,000 people who sent in applications to take those Caterpillar jobs. Incredible, I thought, that people would be willing to take someone else's job like this. The UAW folded, but the anger was so strong that the locals kept rising up again and again and forging a true ongoing battle. Ultimately, in the end, UAW lost. They went back to the contract that Caterpillar wanted. Ultimately, in the end, looking back 20 years, many of those jobs left Central Illinois and went to other places. What also struck me with it was the UAW's arrogance at the time, saying we can take them on by ourselves. There was no mass. All out effort by American unions. The Bridgestone Firestone, Bridgestone, the Japanese company, came to the U.S. And one of the ironies, the American tire industry was collapsing, is that so then we had an influx of foreign tire companies who mostly moved to the South because they didn't have to pay union wages or union protections or dues. And Bridgestone, at one point, and thanks to the skullduggery the steelworkers union, which helped out the workers union, which collapsed, they were able to, read what the company was saying is that we don't have to pay these workers these wages. This was a the rubber industry was gigantic in the 1930s. Also, one of the few unions that integrated in the United States at the time was the Rubber Workers Union. So they had a great legacy, but they didn't know what to do. And I remember speaking to the president of the Rubber Workers Union sometime in the 80s, and I said, "Well, radial tires are coming in. People don't need long-term tires." And he said, "We don't know what to do. We just don't know. It's more than we can do." And then the third thing was Staley. This is a it's a farm product processing company based in Decatur. And what made that even more powerful as a story was that the Staley company was very proud of the work that it did. In fact, it built this beautiful receiving facility to look like a bank to honor the workers who would drop the farmers who were dropping their products off there. And then in the 1950s, the Staley company hired a workplace expert and said, "What should we do with our facility?" And the work expert came back and said, "You need to lay off about half these workers." And they fired the expert and said, "We need to hire more workers." So here was a company proud of its town. Staley's then taken over by a British company that dominates the world sugar industry. And what they recommend is not just cutting wages, but they talk about rolling work weeks where you work 2 days on, 1 day off, and then you work around the clock. So we see three things happening. We see the globalization threat to workers. We see Staley saying that, "I'm sorry, the plant has too many workers. They had about 800 at the time. And not only are we going to reduce the workers, but we're going to put you on jobs where you work nights, you work around the clock for, no, not around the clock, but you will change." Well, who are the workers here? A number of workers at Staley's were single parents and had families to support and had to be home. And they rebelled at this. But they belonged to a tiny little union that really wasn't supported by anybody else. And so they said, "The union can't help us." So they went outside and they found progressive union strategists who said to them, "No, we're going to take on this company." And the interesting thing, which I very rarely see, was that one of the strategists said, "This is not just a worker story, it's a community story." And they said, "We're going to hold meetings, and the only people who can come here are people who come with their families. Families have to be engaged, have to take part." What a wonderful idea that struck me. And then the story of Firestone was. And that was a theme that companies come to America with their own point of view. Until recently, when the German companies came to America, even though Germany's companies are 70% union, unions sit on the boards, when German companies come to America at that time, they didn't pay union wages. They went to the South. There's not one single foreign manufacturer in the automaker that until now was union, although Volkswagen recently shifted. So we became a third world country to well-developed countries. It was much cheaper to make a German car in the United States than it was in Germany. And it's pretty soon that was the case for all the Japanese and Korean companies. So that was the scene.
Your
As
book is you point out these changes in the global economy, these things happening, consolidation in industries, this new use of strike breakers, which really wasn't done much before, all happening here in this one town. You're critical of these changes, but you're also critical of the response of American labor and unions, specifically. What do you think could have been done perhaps differently during those times? You know, the union movement, some of your criticism, being bureaucratic, things like that. What maybe could they have done a little differently?
Well, there's this one great scene where the workers from Decatur go down to Florida to the annual convention, winter convention of the AFL-CIO, and they visit the hotel and say, "Holy mackerel! Look how these people are living! Look at what they're doing!" And they beg the union leaders, "Please come to our aid." You know, these are mostly the Staley workers who belong to this little tiny union, and initially the union leaders didn't want to talk to them, but they ultimately do. But nothing really happened. I think my point of view is initially for many years when American unions were set back, when jobs are lost, instead of taking to the streets or taking action, they took aspirin. They didn't stand up. They didn't fight back. We do see that today. But my argument today with American unions is that the suffering is so deep. Today, only about 5.9% of all private industry workers belong to a union. At one point, it was 30%. That's a tremendous decline. And as my guess, although it's not a good solid figure, is that the level of union density in the United States is about the same as it was at the beginning of the 20th century. Unions are like a small piece of a carpet over the United States. Unions exist in the Northeast, here in the Midwest. For a long time, the largest number of union members were in Illinois and Indiana, Ohio, and sections of California. There are vast areas in the country where unions don't exist. South Carolina prides itself that it is a non-union state, and it's bringing in industry, and about 1.9% of its workforce are union members. So my complaint with unions is that they needed to pull together more. They needed to see the disaster that was coming. They needed to think through, and they needed to embrace the changes. Slowly, unions embraced immigrants. For a long time, they didn't. And then they began doing that. But you still see the split. In fact, tragically, the AFL-CIO broke apart in the last 1990s and early 20s, 2020s. There were a whole group broke off saying the AFL-CIO is not effective, doesn't work, we can't go anywhere. Well, that splinter group eventually collapsed itself. And I think that, workers need to look to unions, need to look to organizations that help them. There are many that are not exactly unions that stand up for their rights. And I, to this day, I wonder if you look at what's happening, if you look at the workers organizing at Amazon and at Starbucks and other places. Well, we're moved by that. Wow. All over the country, we're moved by that. 300 Starbucks shops have been organized. Have they gained anything? No. Has Amazon changed? No. I think, the problem is the laws are so favorable to the companies that workers can't overcome these. But, this should not come from the bottom. I mean, unions have stepped forward. The Teamsters were effective in getting a very good strike with UPS, but then astoundingly, the president of the union goes and talks at the Republican convention. Why is he doing that? What's the message he was sending there? The UAW was successful in getting a very good contract with the automakers, and yet, it's just holding on. We need something more. And let me just jump to the bigger issue is that
Let me
we've launched.
cut you off, Steve. I because I gotta let me ask some questions here as
Sure,
well,
I'm sorry.
please. I gotta do my reintroduction here. You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson. My guest today is Steve Franklin, who's a former Chicago Tribune reporter, a labor reporter, international reporter, and he's also the author of a book called Three Strikes: Labor's Heartland Losses and What They Mean for Working Americans. We're talking a little bit about that book. It concerns some important labor management issues, strikes, work stoppages in Decatur, Illinois, a town of about 80,000 that's southeast here of the Quad Cities. It's a very good book, appropriate for this Labor Day as we're examining the state of American labor here. And I guess you've kind of answered some of my questions I had set up here, but one of the questions was, can labor rise again? I think you pretty well asked that. What is it about the United States, I guess, that you mentioned the statistics there on the percentage of private sector workers that are unionized. It's under, I think, 10% or whatever. What is it about the United States where we don't produce a stronger labor movement? It certainly seems like the conditions have been there at times for it to be so. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I teach a course on comparative labor politics, when you look across the world among the major countries, we have the smallest percentage of organized workers in the workforce. We also are we're by the global trade unions consider us second rate in terms compared to the other major countries of the world in terms of rights and protections for workers. And what am I talking about? Sick pay. Paternal leave, pay raises, seniority rights, all these things. I think the answer is this is part of our social cultural DNA. It's inbred in us. And I guess, there are, you can, there are many reasons why unions are so weak because of the laws, but the laws all come about because there's not support for unions and unions haven't made the case strong enough. And all at the same time, while the unions have struggled, they have always relied upon the Democratic Party, which is, I think, sometimes took advantage or took for granted what workers could do. And so we're stuck with this. And I don't think it's going to get better for a while. I don't see any change at all. I think, again, I'll repeat, every time I go into a Starbucks coffee shop, I say, "How's your union? We don't have one yet." And I think that maybe among younger Americans, there's a sense of progressive desire to work together. And I see that in little tiny places, but I don't see the big movements. And today, I don't know, there is the Trump administration is has I think the numbers they have laid off 300,000 federal workers, both this for economy or just don't want to work with unions. Well, the bedrock of the union's existence are in government workers. Historically, unions may be declining in their private workforce, but in government jobs, they've always remained at least 30 to 35%. Well, the government jobs are union because the government didn't discriminate, didn't turn away unions. And if you also look back at many government jobs, the government didn't segregate for many years. And so that's why you have large numbers of minorities in this work. But when you weaken government unions, you weaken the whole nature of the workforce that stand behind union.
Why
And
is it there? I don't disagree with anything you're saying, but polls show that at least half of union workers have supported Donald Trump and Republican candidates. Have they? I mean, my take on it is, as someone who grew up in a union family, that maybe they're just not aware of the sacrifices that were made earlier, or or they elevate other issues. Like I hear construction unions. Workers are more concerned about gun rights than union rights.
Well, there's a disconnect, and I think it's a terrible, tragic disconnect because you're right. All the surveys have shown surprisingly much more support with the unions. And if you go to people and say, "Hey, how did you get this house? My dad was a steel worker, my mom was a stewardess, my father was a teacher." People just don't realize. And I think, again, that Americans have swallowed or accepted or totally believe that unions are a problem, that they get in the way of workers. The only thing they get in the way of is that low wages, lack of pensions. You know, one of the great tragedies of the United States today is with the loss of a company paid pension, many elderly are working years beyond when they should have. Many elderly are much poorer than they should be. And that's only because of the decline of pensions. If you look, I think if you once upon a time, about 50% of all workers had a company paid pension. I think the number is down to about 5% today. And when you lose that pension, you lose that security. This would not happen in Germany, Scandinavia, England, or France, none of the countries which are our partners, you know, globally. And I think, you know, I don't know, Rob, and I really wish I could explain. I'm baffled by, you know, this it's in our DNA because we all celebrate, you know, my dad came over from Ireland, Germany, you name it, Mexico, we got this job, and yet they don't support unions. And I think it's a combination of union messaging. For a long time, unions are ran by white men. Only recently have they begun to diversify. I wonder how many of your listeners can name who's the president of the AFL-CIO? Who's the president of the AFL-CIO in Illinois? Do they know that? No, they don't. Once upon a time, they did. And I think that, you know, unions have been unfortunately beset by terrible problems, but we just don't recognize it. And we don't care that we don't have a safety net that protects people when they lose their jobs, or, you know, protects the mother who wants to work at the iron plant but doesn't have, you know, nights off. We don't
Why
understand that.
is it so hard to form a union? I mean,
Well,
that we've seen like Amazon, you mentioned Starbucks. There were some auto plants down south that had elections, and unions have won some but lost some. But why is it so hard?
The legal reasons are baked into the system that you have to org first off, you cannot, and you like Europe, organize industry-wide. You have to organize company by company. If we're able to organize every dollar store, that would be wonderful. But we can't. So they have to. So Starbucks now says, well, fine, 300 little coffee shops now have contracts. We'll bargain with them every single one at a time. They seem to have backed down on that. Amazon is challenging. So the process goes through the courts. And in some cases, even when the courts find that the company discriminated, or the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, finds that a company has broken the law, they have to, then they, the union of the workers has to go to court to enforce that. And so it's a legal system that doesn't make things easy for workers. And there have been efforts by the unions to have pro-worker laws passed. They haven't gone very far. And there have been efforts to change the legal, you know, protections for companies. You know, companies can still bring in strike breakers that works. And you'll see the best example is in the current Trump administration, which has gone after what the NLRB did previously. Under Biden, we had a very pro-labor NLRB that really stood up and said, you know, companies cannot hold meetings where workers are frightened and warned that if you join this union, you'll lose your job. The NLRB against that. That's not going to happen under the new Trump administration's rules. And
I
so,
just have time for one more question, Steve. I just got about a minute here. This all sounds, like the state of American labor at this point, is not looking good overall, especially for unions. But are there bright spots? Take about a minute here. Are there any bright spots out there?
well, there are bright spots. The very fact we're talking about this, and the very fact that young people are organizing at places, they need help. And I want to make it very clear, this is not about American labor, it's about American democracy. If we don't have enough money to support ourselves, to support our family, we cannot be a democracy that helps everybody because people need their rights and they need to feel comfortable. And one of the reasons that we see this kickback is when we lost jobs, we blamed it on ourselves. And that should be an end. No more should workers feel embarrassed, broken down, debilitated. They need to be respected.
Well, Kind of a very blunt but assessment of the state of American labor here on Labor Day weekend. I'm very pleased to have as my guest Steve Franklin, who's been talking about labor here this Labor Day weekend. Steve again is a former labor and international affairs reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and he wrote this book that I really recommend. It's a familiar story to all of us here in the Quad City region. We know this, but it really helps to look at this and the impact not only on the companies but and the unions, but the people and the community. And that's why I recommend this book. It's about Decatur, Illinois. It's called Three Strikes: Labor's Heartland Losses and What They Mean for American Workers. And again, Steve Franklin, thank you so much for being on my guest today to talk about the book and the state of American labor.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.